Are there questions for our panel of witnesses that remain? I know there are members that had to leave, but are there any questions for these witnesses? Mr. Spratt.
Mr. Price, let me just make clear from your testimony, is your understanding that the correct rate of sales taxation is 30% per the advocates? They acknowledge that what you would really be paying is 30%. In other words, under their proposal, if I bought a shirt for $10 and paid, I would have to pay under their tax $13 with the sales tax added. They then convert that to 23% by taking the $13 and claiming that the right number to derive is what percentage of 13 is the total tax, and that's 23%. But in truth, the add-on to the price you would pay at the retail count is 30%.
That is correct, and I stress that this is the advocate's own estimate. The estimates from objective analysts is much higher, but even from the advocate's own standpoint, the rate is 30%. They're using a tax-inclusive rate in citing 23%. That's not the way anybody I know calculates the sales tax.
They propose to repeal the individual income tax, the corporate income tax, estate and gift taxes, and FICA, payroll tax.
And payroll tax.
All.
Yes,
so
sir.
This is $1.9 trillion probably, extremely, it's virtually all of the tax base, and consequently, their consumption base to which this sales tax applies has to be extremely broad and all-inclusive also.
That's right. Almost nothing is left out. And as a matter of fact, this 30% rate wouldn't be even close to being revenue neutral. But from their own standpoint, it's 30%.
The base includes new homes, new cars. In our state, new cars at least are exception. New homes aren't taxed. I'm not aware of any place in the United States where new homes are subject to a sales tax, but this would subject a new home. If you had a home priced at $200,000, you'd have to pay $260,000 for it under that proposal. Medical care, which in most places is not taxed, electricity, big rate increase, insurance. And then this comes as a surprise to many people. In order to have a sufficient consumption base to which apply this tax so you can replace all the taxes they would repeal, you have to tax state and local government expenditures under H.R. 25. Is that your understanding?
That's right. National defense expenditures are subject to this tax, as are non-defense federal expenditures. Veterans' health care is subject to the tax. A whole range of things that I think haven't been discussed fully.
Notwithstanding McCulloch v. Maryland and all of these other constitutional precedents about the federal government being able to tax the local government, this for the first time would impose a federal tax, a sales tax, on what county government spent or state government spent. In addition, it would impose a sales tax on what the federal government spends, on what the Pentagon spends. Hundreds of billions of dollars every year would be subject to taxation when the Defense Department spent that money. Now, there was one particular mistake of some magnitude that we'll explore a little bit later when Dr. Gale comes here from the Brookings Institute, and that is, in levying the tax on federal expenditures, the proponents of a national retail sales tax acknowledge the receipt of income from levying that 30% tax, but they don't acknowledge the cost. The fact that if the government has to pay it with one hand, has to receive the money with one hand, it'll be paying it with the other hand. And in fact, you either have to raise the rate to cover the additional cost, or you have to cut government spending by 30%. Do you know if any correction has been made in the sales tax to account for that anomaly?
No, I don't. It will be important to hear from Dr. Gale on this point. I understand that mistake alone is a $500 billion mistake in calculating the amount of revenue we're talking about.
Let me show one last thing as a chart, and I'll turn it over to other members to ask questions of their own. But there we go. As to distribution, as to fairness, which I think is the cardinal objective. This is what a national retail sales tax would do. The bottom line is annual consumption, thousands of dollars. And the bar charts measure the percentage increase in sales and taxes for different income groups. For example, for this would have no exemptions at all. So this is a sales tax that applies to everything. The shift in taxes paid for those who consume between $27,000 and $36,000 a year, modest income Americans, would be 59%. For those consuming between $36,000 and $54,000 per year, the increase in taxes would be 38%. You would have to get to a consumption level well above $135,000 a year, upper income Americans, before the sales tax became a net gainer. For the most part, for middle Americans and low income Americans, this would be a huge shift in the tax burden from the wealthy to those who make wages. Does this comport with your own studies?
Yes, it does. The figures I quoted are slightly different because they refer to North Carolina, and there the average income is a bit lower than the national figure, but those are the correct national figures as far as I know.
Thank you very much.
Before you take that chart off, could you put it back up just so we're clear? I mean, that's before exemption? Is that what that...
Without exemption.
I don't know whose chart that is, so... That's before... I mean, I'm not here to... Mr. Linder, unfortunately, had to go and manage a rule on the floor, and it's his bill. He can defend it just as well on his own, but just so we're clear, I mean, he testified at least that there was a fairly substantial exemption, and this says the burden sales tax without the exemption. So it's fine to put up the chart, but...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I can tell you about my figures, and maybe Mr. Spratt can tell you about his.
Well,
but,
let me just...
My
I'm
figures included the exemption.
Let me finish my
figures
question.
Included the exemption.
Well, that may be, but just so we're clear, because there's a lot of interest in this chart, the sales tax without exemption.
Mr. Chairman, to the best of my knowledge, the bill has no exemptions. That's one of the other unrealistic aspects. It assumes no tax avoidance, no tax evasion, and it provides no exemptions.
Mr. Chairman.
Have a Democrat. It does have a Democrat equal to the sales tax rate times the poverty level, and that Democrat is factored into these figures here.
Again, I'm not trying to argue with you or defend Mr. Linder's bill. That's something he can do. But I'm just to clarify, he testified there was an exemption.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can shed some light on this. All right.
Go ahead and try.
We have a semantic problem, perhaps.
All right.
When I said that the exemption was included, I was in fact referring to the rebate or the Demogrant.
That Mr. Linder was referring to.
That's right.
Okay,
well,
thank
Mr.
you.
Chairman,
that clears, you'll have your own time.
Well,
Mr.
Gutneck
is recognized.
Were you on your time doing that?
I control all the time. Mr. Gutneck.
Well, thank you. There are four different charts, Mr. Chairman. There are four different combinations and permutations with a cash payment, without a cash payment, and with exemptions and without exemptions. And there are four different charts. That was one of them. All of the charts had the same pattern. And if...
Reframing my time,
I'll show all four charts.
Yeah, reframing my time. I mean, we can all have charts. And the problem is... In fact, let me start with, and thanks to my friend, Mr. Wicker. Yesterday we lost a patron saint, Rodney Dangerfield. And in some respects, he was the patron saint of those of us who believe it's time to reform the code. One of my favorite lines from Rodney is he comes home one night, his wife is packing. He says, "Are you leaving?" And she said, "Yes." He said, "Is there another man?" She looked at him and said, "There must be." When you look at the federal income tax code, and it's just amazing to me to listen to some of the discussion, and with all due respect to all the people who have testified, but essentially, for those who are opposed to the national consumption tax, the arguments are about, really come down to the fundamental argument we have around here an awful lot of the time, and that is equality of opportunity versus equality of result. And all of a sudden, we have made the assumption of how people will react if you change the tax code. More importantly, we've forgotten in this discussion we've been having for the last 5 minutes that the truth of the matter is the tax system today isn't fair. It isn't fair to those who save and invest. Now my assumption is, and I know there are people in this room and people in this country who will disagree with me, but my assumption starts with this. There are only three things that people can do with their money. They can spend it, they can save it, or they can pay taxes. Now, if at the end of the day, one of our goals in terms of federal policy is to help grow the economy faster, to encourage more manufacturing jobs to stay here in the United States, to repatriate more of the dollars that are currently being invested around the rest of the world, it strikes me that one of the first things you ought to look at is the tax system. And, essentially what we're saying is, well, we couldn't change that because behavior would remain the same, and therefore we'd have to tax even more. The other thing that, unfortunately, the critics of the national consumption tax have missed, it seems to me, a very important point, and that is that people will get to keep everything they earn, okay? And then they decide whether they're going to spend it or whether they're going to invest it, okay? And I think people will decide, and I have a lot of faith in the American people on how they spend their money. Now, how you handle the rebate, I think anyone, at least I will say, I do understand that the system, if you convert from an income tax system where roughly 20% of the taxpayers pay 80% of the taxes, anything you do to reform that system and try to redistribute the way taxes are collected or any reform is going to create some inequities from the system as it exists today. But that assumes that this system is fair and that it ultimately is good for our economy. I don't assume that, okay? But that's a fundamental debate we have to have. But in terms of getting charts out and saying, well, this is what will happen, I don't think anybody here is smart enough to know exactly how people will react. Once people get to keep all of their paychecks, I think it will change consumer behavior. Now, the other point that the charts tend to ignore and that Mr. Linder pointed out, and that is that there's an enormous amount of money going through the underground economy. We can argue how much that is. We don't know. The truth of the matter is we don't know. But what we do know is if you're a drug dealer and you go down and you buy a brand new Maserati, you're going to pay tax on that. If you buy an expensive yacht, you're going to pay tax on that. And so the great thing about the consumption tax, there are two things that I think are important about the consumption tax, in my opinion. First of all, it recovers an awful lot of the money that is going through the black economy that we do not receive any. They're not filing their taxes, okay? The second thing is it makes American-made manufactured products, American products, period, services as well, because embedded in the cost of every one of those products and services that we try to sell in other places around the world are taxes. Whether we want to admit it or not, and we can argue whether it's 18% or 20% or 22% or 30%. But the bottom line is there are embedded costs in that. And all of a sudden, it makes everything made in the USA anywhere from 18 to 30% more competitive in the international marketplace. I think that's something that's worthy of serious discussion. Now, it's great to be a critic, and it's great to come in here and say, well, we can't do that because this is exactly what will happen. We don't know what will happen. But I think in the end, the consumption tax, like Rodney Dangerfield, gets no respect. But I think the American people are beginning to figure out, you know, we got to get out of this business of predicting equality of opportunity versus equality of result. We have to worry about saying, let's have a system that's fair, and let the American consumer decide how they want to spend the money.
Mr. Evans,
I yield back.
Mr. Chairman, are we operating under the five-minute rule?
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, let me first say that the problem with today's economy is not that sales at Saks Fifth Avenue and Neiman Marcus are in trouble. It's that sales at Walmart and J.C. Penney's and Target have not been increasing like sales at Neiman Marcus and Saks Fifth Avenue. And I want to commend the people for looking at tax reform ideas, but I'll say, Mr. Chairman, there are two common bonds I find in each of these tax reform proposals. One is the promise of no pain, all gain. We've heard that before in 1981 when we were told that we could have massive tax increases, huge defense increases, and balanced budgets. We quadrupled the national debt in 12 years. Well, we heard no pain, all gain in 2001, 2002, and 2003 with tax cuts. And we could increase defense spending, they promised, 20 years after the false promise was made in 1981. we could balance a budget and massive tax cuts. What do? We this year, as a consequence of some of the people proposing tax reform now, have the largest deficit in American history. And I would point out that, Mr. Chairman, while I do welcome this hearing, 2 days before the scheduled end of the 108th Congress, we don't have a budget resolution passed. We hadn't passed 12 out of 13 appropriation bills, and we have the largest deficit in American history, an economy that is struggling for middle-class families. And seems to me we should keep first things first and focus on the huge problems that have been caused by those who promised no pain, simple solutions to massive tax cuts and balancing the budget. What I would like to ask you, Mr. Price, since Mr. Lender understandably could not be here to answer questions, on the national sales tax proposal, I want to be sure I'm correct in what they're proposing. A new home costing $200,000 would have a $60,000 tax added to that $200,000 purchase price. Is that correct?
That's right, assuming a tax rate that made the overall proposal revenue neutral.
Right. And I believe this is a proposal either exactly or almost like it that Majority Leader Tom DeLay has endorsed. Now, so a new home buyer would pay $60,000 sales tax on that new home. Then I understand they would get rid, that bill would get rid of the home mortgage interest deduction. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that's a second burden put on new home purchases for hardworking families. And then the third thing, I understand instead of getting a deduction on your home mortgage interest payment each month, you'd actually have to pay this 30% sales tax on that home mortgage interest payment. I think less 1.5%. So if it's a 6% mortgage, you'd pay 30% tax on 6% minus 1.5%. So what this proposal would do not only is put in a huge increase in tax burden on middle-class families making $40,000 a year with a couple of children, it would devastate the housing and real estate industry, one of the most important segments of our economy, the segment of our economy that kept us from going into a deep recession over the last several years. And you would hammer new home sales in three ways: $60,000 national tax on the sale or purchase of your new home, you would no longer get the home mortgage interest deduction, and you would even have to add insult to injury, pay a tax on the interest payment you pay to the mortgage company every month. And I would just suggest that would be have a devastating impact on one of the most important industries in our country. Do I understand also, Mr. Price, on the lender bill that Mr. DeLay is supporting, senior citizen buys a $300 worth of prescription drugs every month, they're struggling to pay their prescription drug bill, 30% on that would be a $90 tax on $300 of drug purchases every month. Is that correct?
That's right. And if the provision is to be revenue neutral, it would be twice that.
And then even using their underestimated sales tax rate, their 30% rate, if someone struggling making $20,000 a year goes out and buys groceries for what cost $100 today would be $130, and if they bought $100 worth of gasoline over a period of a month or two, that would be a $30 tax on the groceries and $30 new tax on the gasoline, right?
That's my understanding.
But we're going to assume that the market system is so perfect that all these oligopolies and foreign companies selling products to the United States are going to automatically reduce the embedded tax cost. There's no real proof that's going to happen, is there?
No, there's not.
I thank the gentleman.
Thank you. Mr. Wicker, do you have questions for the witnesses?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I had some very pointed and I think excellent questions that I was going to ask Mr. English, but unfortunately he had to leave. Let me just observe one thing and then ask Mr. Price something. There's certainly no such thing as no pain, no gain, or however Mr. Edwards put it. But the fact is, President Reagan led this nation to a significant tax cut in 1981, and revenues increased dramatically. Revenues to the government increased dramatically and the tax tables are there. I could go back to the corner of the room and find them. There's no question about it. We got a lot more money into the Treasury after we cut taxes. Now, Mr. Price, I haven't signed on to this bill either. I think it's good that we're having this debate. I want to commend all of you. You're in the arena. You're thinking. And I think this is one of the most important debates of the next decade. But with regard to your assumptions, Mr. Price, do you discount completely what Mr. Linder says about the built-in cost on everything, whether it's the building supplies that go in to build that house or the ingredients in a loaf of bread over time, that there is a 22%, even some people say as much as 30% built-in cost, a hidden tax because of the way we have an income tax in the United States. Do your calculations totally discount that?
No, they do not totally discount that. There are some built-in costs of those sorts. I do not have precise figures before me, but that's not a totally fallacious analysis. What I think is indisputable, though, is that we're talking here about radical redistribution, and I don't want to take your time, Mr. Wicker, but Mr. Gutnicht was saying that we don't know what kind of behavioral results there are going to be from this. I actually think we can guess pretty well that for the lowest quintile of earners, $99,100 a year average in North Carolina, I think we know how that money is being spent now and how it's going to be spent under any tax code, and that is it's going to be spent on the necessities of life because that's what's required. And we also know that under this proposal, these people would pay $4,214 more in taxes. That, I think, is virtually indisputable.
Well, I'd be happy to yield. You're so much better than I am, sure.
For him to say that it's indisputable, if you get all of your money back, how do you lose?
Excuse me? What money
if
are you...
If you get all of that tax money back from the federal government, how does that family lose?
The family is not getting all that money back.
Yes,
this includes...
Under the Linder plan, they get it all back.
My calculation includes that rebate. My calculation.
How do they lose if they get all their money back?
They don't get all their money back. They get a certain portion of the sales tax money back. But they lose the EITC. They lose all of the EITC. They lose the refundable child tax credit. They lose the dependency care tax credit. They lose the hope and lifetime learning tax credits. The average loss for those low-income families, the average additional tax burden for those low-income families is well over $4,000.
And I appreciate my friend, and I was sincere when I complimented my friend from Minnesota because he's done a lot of study on this subject. But let me make sure I understand, David. When you give the chart about North Carolina and you talk about the extra money that that person in a certain income bracket is going to pay extra, you do not assume for purposes of argument Mr. Linder's assumption that the loaf of bread itself will cost less because of the absence of the built-in cost of the income tax throughout the process. You do not assume that for purposes of your chart, do you?
I do not have a precise assumption as to
So if he's correct about that, that there is this hidden built-in 22% cost of a loaf of bread, which do not be there, then your numbers would not add up, would they? Because you don't assume that that's a fact at all.
No, the changes would be the changes, I think, in those numbers would be minor. I'm drawing here.
If you don't build them into your chart about North Carolina,
I'm drawing on the work of four institutions here, and the exact assumptions about costs I can furnish you for the record. But basically, nothing comes close. Even Mr. Linder's own assumptions don't come close to a 60% surcharge, basically, on these consumer goods. They don't come close.
Now, how do you explain the fact that so many of the European countries that are left-wing, that are considered so progressive, rely heavily on a consumption-based tax?
They rely on a value-added tax, which has a modest tax on various stages of the production process. It's not levied all at once on all consumer goods and transactions. And moreover, it's not layered on top of state and local taxes, which in this country, of course, already approach 10% in many jurisdictions. Sales taxes, I mean.
Mr. Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Price, you indicated that they're already... You talked about... You had one of these charts up. Let's just go through all four of them right quickly. You can go through all four of the different charts. This is tax with a payment, without exemptions. And the next chart. And the next chart. Well, the next one.
We'll give you some time here, Bobby, at the end. Just
well, as just we're let me ask another question. Mr. Burgess, did you, does your plan expect to raise the same amount of revenue that we're raising now?
I'm sorry, I was distracted with your question.
To Mr. Burgess.
I'm sorry.
Do you expect to raise the same amount of money that we're raising now?
Under the bill introduced by Congressman Armey and previous Congresses, that was scored to be revenue neutral. Now, I do not have figures back from Joint Committee on Taxation about a voluntary flat tax, and obviously the behavior may be different and the scoring may be different. So I do not have that information for you, but when it becomes available, I'll make it available to
you. Does your voluntary flat tax exempt capital gains, interest, and dividends from taxation?
That is correct.
So that if a person has...
If a person opted in, from the business aspect, opted into the flat tax.
Right. I mean, you have an option not to pick which form you're in. So if you make all of your money in capital gains, interest, and dividends, you would pay no tax.
That is correct.
Okay. And if you pay less tax, then somebody else has to pay more tax to be revenue neutral. Everybody can't pay less tax and raise the same amount of money.
But I would point out Mr. Wicker's point that when you reduce the capital gains tax, you end up increasing productivity in the country, thereby increasing the tax base.
Some people will pay less tax, and no one will have to pay more tax. Is that your testimony?
Well, at the present time, I don't have a precise answer for you. Okay. But the increase in productivity was felt to be on the flat tax the basis for allowing the flat tax to be revenue neutral. To what extent we will capture that with a voluntary flat tax, I'm not certain.
Joe, did we get the... that's exempting with exemptions... Without without a cash payment, and the next one. That's with a cash payment, exempting. Basically, with all combinations and permutations, you have the same form. Right around $100,000 in consumption, you start paying less. Under that, you're paying more. Mr. Linder, under this form, I like a progressive form of taxation where the more you make, the higher percentage of your income goes to taxation, and ability to pay is important. Someone who makes $100,000 and spends $50,000, someone who spends $50,000 and spends $50,000, and someone who makes $40,000 in income and spends $50,000 because they borrowed money to buy the car, all spent the same amount, but in my view would have different abilities to pay. You're one of the more thoughtful members of the of Congress, and I appreciate that. Does ability to pay factor into your calculation as who should pay how much?
Frankly, this tax is progressive. Nobody will be taxed on anything up to the poverty line. Today, people are losing 22% of the purchasing power to the current system. Everybody will get to keep their entire check, no deductions for payroll tax or income tax. And the more you spend, the more you pay. But we need to get out of the business of worrying about who pays what. If Bill and Melinda Gates want to move to a farm and grow the groceries and live off the rebate, why should we care? We'll borrow their money and we'll create jobs with it. Cost about $100,000 to create a job in this country.
Does your, for the very low income, does your plan eliminate the earned income tax credit, child tax credits, and other tax credits such as that?
Correct. Correct. We have no taxes on income whatever. So currently, if you're living, if you're spending 100% of what you earn, you lose 22% of your purchasing power to the embedded cost of the IRS at retail.
Let me get into a couple of quick questions then. You pay tax on the new car, but not a used car?
Correct. Only new goods.
You pay tax on a new house and not an old house?
Correct. Let me touch the house thing for
And let me ask another question and you can get them all in. And if you buy something from purchasing made in Canada, sold to somebody in Canada, and then you kind of buy it with the car with 50 miles on it as an individual, you wouldn't pay?
No, there would be a cost of customs. There would be a cost of customs to everything coming in. Let me deal with the house. Currently, 28% of what we spend on a new house represents the embedded cost of the IRS. Any new construction, 28% of that new construction is the embedded cost of the IRS. You're paying all the business taxes and compliance costs of every business entity that had a role in producing the products that go into the production of that new house. Under our system, it would be 23%. So the house would be less expensive. Under our system, if you make $60,000 a year, you take home $5,000 a month. Currently, you take home $3,800 a month. So you have an easier time making the payment. And interest rates fall by 30% because the difference between a municipal bond rate and a corporate bond is essentially a tax complication. We have no taxes on investment. Interest rates will fall by 30%. 66% of us file a short form and don't take advantage of the interest deduction anyway. So we think housing will do very well under this system because people have more money to take home.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Lennon, I know that we all have a concern with the current tax codes and we're all trying to make a fix for it. And I appreciate your presenting your plan today. And we've talked about, while you were out of the room, about whether it's a 23% the consumption tax or whether it's a 30%. And have you heard a debate on that? Whether which is accurate? And I guess your plan is revenue neutral, right?
That's correct. There's never been a. I've also heard that's been bruited about here, it's a 50% tax. I want to deal with that first, and then I'll come to yours. There's never been an analysis of H.R. 25. Joint Committee for Taxation did an analysis of a bill that they thought might pass and changed it dramatically. It got an increased rate. The 25 or 27-page release last week by the Democrat minority analyzed a bill that was not my bill. We've done everything we could to find out how the got the analysis. The most interesting thing to me is that nobody, whoever did the analysis, didn't sign it. But nothing has ever been done to on our bill to analyze what the cost would be. We say it's an inclusive 23 cents. We compare it with the tax we're replacing, which is an inclusive tax. You pay 36% of everything you earn today. Under ours, you pay 23% of everything you spend. If we were to treat it like a state sales tax, which would be you spend a dollar and it's on top of that, it would actually be a 29.9% tax. But then if you're going to compare it to the income tax and divide the $64 you have left to spend out of your $100 you earn after you give the government $36, divide 64 into 36, you get a exclusive income tax of 56%. So if you're going to compare it to exclusive, I'll be the first to tell you it's 30%. Compared to 56% income tax exclusive, or it's 23% inclusive of what you spend, just like you're giving the government 36% inclusive of what you earn.
Under the current plan, approximately 43% of Americans don't pay any federal income tax.
I think it's 47% now.
that could then pay an income tax now. And so it's difficult to formulate a plan that it will have the bumps in it. If people aren't paying any now, I know that under your plan you have some rebate coming back to try to offset some of that deficiency, but according to Mr. Price, apparently all of that is not included. Is that correct?
We provide for every household a check at the beginning of every month sufficient to totally rebate the tax consequences of spending up to the poverty line. Poverty level spending, by definition in this country, is that spending necessary for a given sized household to buy your essentials. Using that definition, we effectively untax essentials. For a family of one, that's $9,500 a year. For a family of four, it's about $25,000. For a family of six, it's about $30,000. They would spend that much money totally untaxed.
You agree with that, Ms. Branch? I know you said it was $4,000. Is it?
Yes, I don't believe Mr. Linder disputes the studies that suggest that. And where that comes from is from the cancellation of the earned income tax credit, the removal of other credits that many of these lower income families now enjoy, the child tax credit, the dependency care tax credit, the hope and lifetime learning credits. These studies that I cited are virtually unanimous in suggesting that for a person in that bottom quintile, that is in North Carolina, someone making on average only $9,100 a year, that they would be paying $4,214 more than they're paying now in taxes.
I dispute that.
Does your proposal preserve, for example, the earned income tax credit, which is what accounts for most of this problem?
An individual earning $9,100 a year in North Carolina or any other state would pay no taxes whatever.
We're not talking about whether they pay no taxes whatever. We're talking about how much they would lose vis-a-vis what they now pay. That's a differential figure. All of my figures I quoted have to do with additional tax burden that everybody but the top 5% would incur.
Nothing in our bill prevents the Congress from making available cash contributions or grants to any family whatever. All we do is change the income paradigm to a consumption paradigm. The income paradigm is a limited... first of all, we had 8 quarters in a row of declining revenues to the federal government from the middle of 2001 to the middle of 2003. Under our proposal, the last 14 quarters would have been only 2 quarters that have a modest decline, so we'd have dramatically increased revenues to the federal government. But nothing that we do precludes the Congress from making grants to families on any basis whatever. All we do is change the way we raise revenues. And it's a more steady predictor of economic activity than is the income economy. In 2003, we had about $9.1 trillion, roughly, in consumption. The adjusted gross income against which we levy an income tax for the nation was about $4.2 trillion. So the consumption economy was twice as large as the adjusted gross income economy. You have a dramatically reduced tax and raise the same revenues. But we do not take any other positions with respect to programs. If you want to give a grant to a family, a low-income family, you're perfectly willing to do that. You're just not going to be able to use the income tax system to do it with.
All I'm saying is, whatever the hypothetical future programs may be, we're talking here about the instant impact of H.R. 25. That is those are the ground rules of the analysis. We're looking at the impact on various income quintiles of this particular proposal.
Are you aware that those people will not pay any payroll taxes either?
I'm quite aware of that. This is taken into account, as is the rebate feature that you've written into the bill.
Mr. Emanuel.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for holding the hearing. I think just to take a step back, in fact, if you look at the code today, and I think it's ironic we're having this hearing on the fact that there's some discussion of passing another tax cut, which would actually further complicate the code, like the additional 3 that were passed from 2001 forward, that now we're becoming bastions and advocates for reforming the code and simplifying it, when the last 3 tax cuts did anything but that, number one. Number two, what I find interesting is that everybody that's talked about how Europe has a consumption model. Many of those countries also have an income tax on top of the consumption model, and that gets left out of the discussion. Three, the one consistent point about all these reforms is there's a regressive nature to them. That is the thing that you can say is most consistent. If you take a step back, in 1986, when we simplified the code and reduced deductions and definitions, and we had basically three categories for income, we made great progress on simplification. The problem is since 1986 is that, and it's been under Democratic administrations and Republican, in achieving certain social goals, whether that's in healthcare, whether that's in savings, whether that's in affording college education, we have loaded up the tax code with credits and deductions and therefore made it more complicated. And that is, we don't aspire to expand Pell Grants by putting more money into it. So what do we offer? Is a tax deduction. We do that on other areas. As an example, I'm for the tax deduction on higher education, but I'd be for a massive expansion of public financing of higher education. We decided not to do that. We gave it as a tax credit. We all, since 1986, basically in the last 18 years, have made the code more complicated. And to tell you the truth, it's never been worse the last 3 years. So, number one, or number two on that point, I would say I've advocated, and John knows this, we've talked about it, he doesn't particularly like the idea, which makes me even warmer to my idea at some points, is that because I've offered an idea of a simplified family credit. It takes the earned income tax credit, the per child, and the dependent care, and makes it one credit, takes 2,000 pages of the code down to 12 questions, and takes that segment of the population, you'd reach well over 30 million families, and reduces the tax burden, simplifies it, and makes it more progressive. Now, one of my objections to all the plans here, whether it's flat or consumption, is that they all, in one way or another, are more aggressive. Yes, they do shift the burden to consumption away from savings, hopefully encouraging savings, but they end up, regardless, more regressive in nature. Now, I don't believe, since we can't reform health care, I don't believe we're going to throw out the tax code and end up with a consumption code, based code. It's not going to happen. So take a segment of the population and try to reform the code and simplify it for that area. Now, I believe a lot of times, you know, Ronald Reagan was the one that created the earned income tax credit. I believe, but Bill Clinton, under his administration, expanded it. I believe it's a very good credit. It is progressive. Richard Nixon admired it. Ronald Reagan created it. Bill Clinton expanded it. But we have about $8 billion worth of some type of fraud or abuse you all hype on all the time. And the main reason is because of complexity. Now, I think if we simplify the earned income tax credit and the dependent care and the per child and put it into one family credit, you would achieve a great deal of progressivity and a great deal of simplicity and do it the right way. But the notion that we're going to take the code and allow and throw it out, I don't think is politically possible, and I don't think it would end up with the results we want. Lastly, because of the complexity we have in the code, $340 billion goes uncollected and underreported, mainly by very wealthy individuals who can game the system. And that's where the fraud exists. Now, I'll be willing to attack and tackle the fraud in the earned income tax credit, but I find the silence deafening on the other side when it deals with what has happened in the last 3 years. All of it reported, all of it by IRS, not exactly political entities, saying that the major part of fraud that exists in the system and the major types of problems, because $350 billion goes unreported, we basically cut the deficit by more than what the president's promising in 5 years. We do it in 1 year. It happens mainly on very wealthy individuals who are moving their income and their tax contribution outside this country and basically try to figure out games to not pay it. And I know I have a couple seconds left. Saturday's New York Times reported in a little story that in 2004, we had more individuals than ever making $200,000 above who paid no income taxes at all. Highest ever, year over year. That is from 2004 to 2003 in a story. And that's where this code is regressive. It needs to be reformed. You should take the lower mid-moderate income people, simplify it for them. You'd be progressive and reach simplification.
Does the gentleman have legislation on that?
I do.
Thank you for bringing that up. We appreciate any proposal for simplification and reform. I'm serious. That's the reason I'm asking. Do you have a bill number? The record. If you don't, we'll put it in the record later. But I appreciate that.
I knew you'd try to make me act like a legislator once. I don't have a bill number here. I don't.
You can act like.
I didn't expect any movement, so I don't remember any of the. I don't have to.
Today is called Federal Revenue Options, so all of the options are on the table. And
I do appreciate the fact that we're having this hearing. This is going to be, I think, regardless of who wins in November, the piece of reform we're going to do, and I think we got to all seriously look at it. I don't think you're going to throw out the entire code. It's not going to be accomplished. So can we take a part of the population and achieve the two goals of progressivity and simplicity? I offer that as
That's part of the discussion today. Mr. Neal.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. After all those years that we've spent on the Ways and Means Committee, I'm not nearly as optimistic as Mr. Emanuel is about what we're going to do with the tax code. I'd like to yield two of my minutes to Mr. Edwards, and then I'd like to come back with a question I've had from my friend John Linder.
I thank the gentleman. Mr. Burgess, I want to ask about your proposal. Do I understand that someone making $1 million a year in capital gains and dividend income would pay $0 in taxes on that income?
That's correct. This is a consumption tax, and capital gains and dividend income would not be taxed.
You would have no tax on that?
That's correct.
But an Army sergeant making $30,000 a year who just returned from Iraq, would that sergeant pay taxes on his $30,000 salary for having served his country in uniform?
The standard exemption for a family of four would be 200% of the poverty level, or about $36,500.
So an Army sergeant with one child would pay more taxes under your plan than someone sitting here safely at home making $1 million a year in dividend and capital gains income?
Tell me the income that you're reporting for that individual.
Let's just say it's a first sergeant making $40,000 a year with one child. Would that sergeant just return home from Iraq, serving our country in Iraq, pay more in taxes than someone sitting here at home who just made $1 million a year in dividend and capital gains income?
That is correct, but I think, as Mr. Emanuel just pointed out before he left, the tax avoidance that is currently going on allows that to happen every day of the week right now.
Thank you for answering the question. So someone making $1 million a year, sitting here safely at home, would pay $0 in taxes, wouldn't even contribute to the cost of national defense for which that person is benefiting, but the Army sergeant having to defend our country would pay more taxes than that person. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Even though Mr. Linder and I disagree with the proposal he's offered, I must tell you that he's approached this very thoughtfully, and I think it kind of elevates the discussion that we've had in the House over the last 2 years. But let me ask you something, John, if I can. Dick Armey's going to testify, the former majority leader. And in an article that he offered in 1995, he wrote, quote, "Any sales tax will inevitably become a complex, pervasive, multi-rate, value-added tax. Evasion at the retail level will necessitate reaching back into various levels of production to ensure compliance and adequate revenues." He also went on to warn, "A national sales tax may well exempt many basic necessities from this tax. This will lead to bitter disputes over the differences between food and candy, between real clothes and costume accessories." Finally, he doesn't hold out much hope for the abolition of the IRS either. He goes on to say, "Under a sales tax, there is no direct tax on individuals, so businesses will be responsible for collecting several times what they collect today. That means IRS scrutiny of American businesses could be expected to rise proportionately." John, why is it that Dick Armey so thoroughly dislikes your proposal?
Because he's got his own proposal he authored, and he'd like to have us consider it. He's simply wrong. I mean,
did you ever say that while he was majority leader?
Sure, I did. He's simply wrong. A universal across-the-board tax on personal consumption would be the easiest tax to collect. Most states, 45 states, collect sales taxes. They claim 90 to 92% compliance. Under the current system, all you have to do is lie on your tax return and send it in, and your wife doesn't even have to know about it. Under our system, you have to have two people conspire to cheat. I don't know how many friends you have that are willing to save you 23%. I have none. If they have a risk going to jail, we have an underground economy. Ron was wrong about the $350 billion in the underground economy that's avoided. we have just three components of the underground economy: pornography, illicit drugs, and illegal labor, that constitute a $1 trillion underground economy. Untaxed. It would be the easiest tax to collect. The reason we have no exclusions or exemptions is so that nobody gets in a fight in front of your committee about what is a necessity. We define necessities as up to poverty level spending and leave it at that. And everybody gets that check no matter how much they make. I would like a system that gives the American people in a free society the privilege of anonymity. Nobody should know as much about us as the IRS does. I would like a system where the only role for the IRS is about 5,000 people in the Treasury Department that contract with the states. The states get a quarter of a point for collecting the tax. The retailer, whomever sells you the product, gets a quarter of a point for collecting the tax. But we contract with the states to do the collecting for us. And there will be some problems. And there will be some cheating. We're Americans. We cheat. But we cheat on the current system. I don't know if you've ever owned a company and taken your wife out to dinner and wrote it off as a common expense. But I know some people who have. That's cheating. It's going to be tough for the states to collect money on services. What's going to happen is the guy who paints your house, personal consumption, is going to charge you the tax and not remit it. That's the biggest risk we have. But already the IRS says they're collecting 75% of what they know is due. Charles Rossetti has just recently written a book in which he says there are $300 billion a year that we know is due and it's not collected. It's just not collected. So there's going to be cheating. I think we'll have better than a 75% compliance rate. I think we'll get a significant part of the underground economy. But the most important thing, and this is the most important point in any tax reform, we must get the tax component out of the price system. It is crazy for us to continue to sell goods and services into a global economy with a 22% tax component in the price system. And for those people who, I think it was Mr. Emanuel said, are leaving, going offshore with their money, I think I mentioned there's $6 trillion offshore. There's a reason for that. A confiscatory tax policy is chasing people and jobs away. And if we got rid of the tax on capital labor, we would be the world's tax haven. Those trillions would be in our economy, creating jobs in America.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I would disagree with the latter part of that statement strongly, and the fact that our committee over the Ways and Means Committee, in fact, has been reluctant to take up the issue of offshoring. And is apparently not going to take it up again in the FISC bill that's going to be before us in the next couple of days, I think indicates how little enthusiasm there really is for chasing down that money that's owed.
Well, the way to fix it is not to punish people. The way to fix it is to change the tax code so they are attracted here.
A minute?
Well, not a minute, but
30 seconds. The idea that corporations move profit offshore in a time when there are 135,000 American soldiers in Iraq and 12,000 in Afghanistan, and they preach patriotism and they put profits between patriotism, simply outrageous. Thank you, Chairman.
Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me try to go back to the colloquy that Mr. Price, Mr. Linder were having when I initially walked in the room. If I understood it correctly, Mr. Linder, your mindset and your argument is that your sales tax proposal would actually remove the tax burden from a significant number of low-income, lower-middle-income individuals, and it would cancel out a certain portion of liability that they would otherwise hold. And if I understood his point correctly, Mr. Price's argument is that while it might be the case that the sales tax would not incorporate such things as the Earned Income Tax Credit, the Child Tax Credit, any host of other redistributive features, if you will, of our tax system. That was the philosophical debate you all were having. Mr. Linder, your response was, well, it may well be the case that under a consumption-based system we would sacrifice certain redistributive elements, but I think your quote was there's nothing that would prevent this Congress from engaging whatever grant-making that it wished to do, whatever direct transfers of cash that it wished to do that might in effect serve the same purpose as these things, such as the Earned Income Tax Credit. My first question to you is, it strikes me that, and you've obviously been here a lot longer than I have, but it strikes me that this is an institution that appears to be very, very deeply reluctant, and our whole political culture seems somewhat reluctant to embrace the idea of giving poor people anything.
when we have managed to give poor people something, it's almost always been in the context of something like the earned income tax credit or the child tax credit. In other words, we've had to staple our generosity onto the very familiar vehicle of the progressive tax system. Do you think that there would be any political enthusiasm in this capital on your side of the aisle if we were to do away with the income tax system? Do you think there would be any political enthusiasm on your side of the aisle for making direct cash transfers to low-income Americans?
Yes.
And what's your basis for that? Because Richard Nixon proposed doing that in the early 70s, and Ronald Reagan strongly opposed it. A number of people in his party strongly opposed it, and I don't know of any bills on your side of the aisle that would do that.
The earned income tax credit is one of those things that was, I believe, sponsored by Dan Quayle.
But it's stapled onto
I believe sponsored by Dan Quayle.
I mean, my point is that if you take away the progress, I understand that we've got enthusiasm for it and the familiar guise for progressive tax structure. But if, as you want to do, you slice away the progressive tax structure, where's the political enthusiasm to do the equivalent of what the child tax credit does, the equivalent of what the earned income tax credit does, through just a direct transfer of cash or some other kind of allotment? Wouldn't that be just, wouldn't your side denounce that as welfare and giving people something for nothing?
We've had a Republican chairman of the Agriculture Committee for about 10 years, and they haven't destroyed the WIC program yet. 62% of the agriculture budget goes to food programs for low-income people. It has not been taken away. I just think you're wrong.
Let me give you
the whole
notion.
Do you mind if I?
Well, sure.
The whole notion that we're some kind of ogres that don't like poor people is just simply wrong. I never lived a day above the poverty line until I was in the Air Force.
All right. Well, rather than have you engage that straw man, let me give you a very specific recent example. When Congress was debating the expansion of the child tax credit last year, as you know, initially the House bill, unlike the Senate bill, did not expand the child tax credit from $600 to $1,000 for certain portions of Americans earning less than $26,000 a year. And when Mr. Laura, Mr. Rangel, and myself introduced a bill that would correct that discrepancy, the response from many on your side of the aisle was, well, a lot of these folks really aren't paying income taxes, or the income taxes they're paying are so low that they don't deserve this benefit. So the argument was that we shouldn't be engaging a redistribution for people who aren't paying taxes.
Did they get the benefit in the final analysis?
It was about 14 months later, and initially they didn't get it. As you recall, your leadership wouldn't even bring it to the floor.
Did they get it ultimately?
After 15 months, and only after producing a bill that stuck a lot of things that were completely unrelated.
You're welcome.
That kind of leads to my next point.
You're welcome.
One of the... that conveniently leads to my next point. Mr. Emanuel, I think, made a very sound argument that the hallmark of tax simplification was the 86 reform, which I concede to you was bipartisan, and President Reagan embraced it. We've had a long-running retreat from that hallmark of simplification in the last 18 years. Now, I think you would concede to me that your party has been in control of the Congress since 1994. You've been in control of all three branches for the last 4 years, and I think it would be enormously difficult to argue that we've had greater simplification and not less. The chair would just let me finish this question up. It's near impossible to argue that we've had greater simplification, not less, in the last 4 years. As you know, the corporate tax bill that we'll see on the floor perhaps as early as tomorrow is undoubtedly one that will contain a number of additional elements of complexity. A lot of the bills from past the last several years have that feature. So my question to you is, why has your party been so resistant to tax simplification in the last 4 years?
You're not speaking to me on that one. I'm an author of a bill that goes from 55,000 pages of regulations to 132 pages. You're going to come to this because the public is going to demand it. The people are so far ahead of the politicians on this issue, it's amazing.
No, I hear that, but I just want to get one simple answer to my question, if I can.
Why don't we let the witness answer?
Well, I'd like to, but I'd simply like to get an answer as to why your party has consistently been resistant to tax simplification
witness
the last 4 years.
That's fine. The gentleman's time has expired. The witness may answer the question.
I did.
Okay. I'd like to use my time to end up by offering our witnesses who have been very patient and have engaged in what I think has been a very spirited, high-minded debate here today, which I think has been excellent. I think this has been an excellent kickoff to a discussion that we have to have, regardless of where it ends up and regardless of people's opinions This is the kind of discussion that members need to have on this policy. We're going to disagree, and that's fine. That's what this is about, but at least we're having the discussion. And what I'd like to do is to use my time offering it to the witnesses to wrap up, to close, to give their final thoughts before they leave, and I'll go in reverse order because Mr. Linder's bill has been the subject of probably the most discussion today. I'm going to give you the chance to be the last one. Mr. Price, I'll start with you, and then Mr. Burgess, and then Mr. Linder. 2 minutes each, just to kind of sum up what your feelings are on tax reform here today as we move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do think it's been a good discussion, and I commend you for holding the hearing and the obvious interest to the members in pursuing these issues. I hope this will be on the agenda as a lead item, however the elections come out in the next Congress. As I said at the beginning of my statement, I think there's widespread support for the basic bargain of tax reform, which is simplification and lower rates in exchange for less in the way of credits and deductions. That was the bargain struck in 86, more or less, and I think it's a bargain that we could strike now, although one is always struck with how much devil there is in the details of figuring out just which credits and deductions are dispensable and exactly what the terms of that bargain are. My main focus here today has simply been on the question of the fairness of the tax code and the implications of both the flat tax and H.R. 25, the national sales tax, for how that burden is distributed. And I do believe that there's very little dispute that we're talking with both proposals, and I've focused on the latter. We're talking about a major redistribution of the tax burden away from the 5% wealthiest taxpayers to almost everyone else, including some of the poorest people in this country. And it's been interesting to me to hear Mr. Linder basically acknowledge that we're talking here about an increased burden of some $4,000 on the average taxpayer in that lower quintile. And he's saying some interesting things, I think, about the possibility of additional congressional action then that would rectify that. But the point holds that H.R. 25, the proposal we're talking about, does have that profoundly regressive impact. I don't believe that's been disputed here today, and I know you're going to hear from other witnesses who will have more in the way of technical backup for that proposition. So I think the basic case for a progressive tax code where we affirm that principle from whom much has been given, much will be required, and that those who have benefited most from the blessings of our society have a special responsibility for maintaining the common good. I think that principle is sound, and I would hope that whatever we do by way of tax simplification could also honor that principle of fairness.
Thank you for helping us engage in this debate today, Mr. Price, and again, welcome back to the Budget Committee. Mr. Burgess, for 2 minutes to get the last word in.
Well, again, I thank the Chairman of the Ranking Member for holding this hearing. I thank the members who've stuck with us through the long morning. I think we've heard some good ideas today. Again, I am not an expert, but simply wanted to continue an idea that back in 1995 or 1996, I thought was an exemplary idea, and I couldn't understand why Congress would not enact it. Again, back in 1986, the tax code was simplified, and unfortunately, it was not left alone. Perhaps if it had been, or perhaps if we went back to those changes back in 1986 and left them alone, that would be a good enough change. But I'm afraid without some sort of fundamental change in our tax code, we in Congress, from what I've seen in the past 20 months, we don't have the ability to not meddle in something, even if it seems to be working okay. Finally, as far as Mr. Price's comments about those who've had the blessings of the American society, and certainly I am one of them, and I am certainly willing to pay my fair share. The issue is, though, why do we have to make it so painful to do that? Why does it cost $100 billion a year for the American taxpayer to have to do that? And Mr. Edwards, that would include the young sergeant coming back from Iraq. Why is it that our tax compliance could be increased by 90% and we won't take the simple steps to do that? So I'm certainly not someone here who has all the answers, but I am grateful that the committee saw fit to have this discussion, certainly in Mr. Bush's second term, he has said we're going to address in a great deal more detail, and I look forward to being part of the discussion then. Thank you.
Thank you for helping us engage in this debate. Mr. Linder, for the actual last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for having this discussion. I hope this is a beginning and not an end. There's a lot of good ideas around that. We ought to listen to all of them. I do not agree with Mr. Price that there's a $4,000 burden on some low-income people. I've not seen any studies of my bill yet. I've seen a lot of studies of bills similar to mine, or other people think it might pass, but I've seen no studies of my bill. The fact of the matter is, my tax is a tax on accumulated wealth. People who have paid taxes all their life and paid tax when they sold the company and are paying tax on the interest it earns are going to pay tax one more time when they spend it. And to those people, I just say you're already paying this tax. People living at or below the poverty level today are losing 22% of their purchasing power to the current system. Under my system, they would not pay that tax, prices would fall, and they'd be everybody would be rebated the tax up to the poverty line. This is going to be a long discussion, and it's a complicated discussion. I think the people are so far ahead of the politicians that they're going to demand a simplification of the code. We have gotten so out of line with income tax, I don't think it's fixable. When 49 tax preparers were sent the same information from Money Magazine, they had 49 different tax returns, none of which were right. And 50% of the answers you get from the IRS on the help wanting to do your tax returns are given to you in error. I'm reminded of a comment made in 1911 or 12 when they were starting to discuss the income tax. And a Southern senator was ridiculed and laughed off the floor of the Senate for saying something terribly outrageous. This is what he said. Mark my words, before this is over, they'll be taking 10% of everything you earn. Which gives fresh meaning to my favorite country song, if 10% is enough for Jesus, it ought to be enough for Uncle Sam.
I thank the gentleman. This has been it really has been a good discussion, and I hope members have learned from it and taken something away. We appreciate the members of our panel who have stuck with us and helped us with this discussion, and this will no doubt continue as we go into the next Congress. With that, we will dismiss this panel. Thank you again. We next will turn to our second panel, and we will invite those witnesses forward.